Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
I'm Lisa Held, a food journalist and podcast host presenting Behind the Label with American Humane. Produced by Heritage Radio Network for Springer Mountain Farms, this podcast series dives into what the American Humane Certified Label really means. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
This week on Meat & Three, we're spotlighting the people who prepare our meat before it reaches our plates. We hear from whole animal butchers, the brains behind a meat vending machine, California cattle ranchers, and a master of charcuterie who isn't using meat at all.
It's like a smoked and grilled center stalk of the broccoli, and then it gets finished with some mustard, barbecue sauce, and sauerkraut.
Ranching and farming being as difficult as it is, you know, it's just one thing after another. And at some point, you just give up.
I had a wild idea that if I learned butchery, maybe I could start to be kind of a link in the supply chain.
Listen to Meat & Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Each week, I interview someone who inspires me with their words of wisdom, and today, these words of wisdom are from a spectacular writer as well as a world-renowned baker. My guest today is Lisa Donovan, who's just published a book, Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you, Dana. Very excited to finally be on here with you.
I'm so excited to have you. I read the book, and I really felt like the themes and sub-themes that I was excited to explore with you today are about motherhood, womanhood, and money. Some really, really big topics. And I guess I want to jump right in with this notion of motherhood, because throughout the book, you're defining yourselves in terms of being a daughter, in terms of being a mother, and the roles that played in your life. Maybe we could just start with your family, start with your mom and the heritage that you were born into and the ways in which that's shaped you as a human and a writer and a baker.
Oh, that is jumping right into the deep end, so thank you. You know, this was hard to write because I think the tropes are tropes for a reason, and the old trope of, you know, mothers and daughters having these occasionally fraughtful or complicated or simply just complex relationships is not untrue of mine and my mother's relationship. We somehow managed to be simultaneously very close to one another, and I'm madly in love with her as a daughter. And also still can sort of hold this understanding of the things that are very different for me. My drive and my ambition and my goals have always been not only just a curiosity to my mother, but also a source of sort of frustration for her. I think there's a real divide in what I need to feel like an accomplished human than what she ever needed. And so we've sort of had that expanse between us as I've maneuvered and moved my way through my younger and middle adult life. And those kinds of things, I mean, just to sort of speak frankly about it, you know, create division between women. And I think so much of this book was me trying to figure out why it's so hard for women to be present for other women in certain ways, especially familial women. And so so much of this was me trying to sort of untangle the stories that my mother comes from that maybe could be the root cause of how we just sort of couldn't ever quite get in line with each other as far as an understanding of what we each valued. And that's not to say that we haven't had a deeply loving relationship, but I think I crave something that's hard for her to provide, which is sort of a more intimacy and more sort of her real identification of who I am. I feel like a lot of mothers of that generation sort of vaguely see their daughters and instead of exactly seeing their daughters. So, you know, I really was trying to have a real frank conversation with myself about why that was and how I sort of could heal that for the both of us.
And when you talk about the generation your mother comes from and her circumstances specifically, like, what do you think her experience was that made your ambition difficult to stomach or to honor or to see?
I think that women of my mother's generation and of our class structure as well. My family is incredibly lively and wonderful and interesting and dynamic in so many ways, but we're not a legacy family. We're not an Ivy League family. Still, I'm the only woman to go to college in both sides of my family. My father is the first person to graduate from college on both sides of my family. He's the only one with a PhD, and he dropped out of high school at 17 to marry my mom. And I come from this world where there just weren't a lot of expectations built into people in general, I think. And my parents escaped that. My parents actively made a decision, which I've always honored, to leave that space of sort of, this gets tricky for me because I find so much value in working class. I am a working class person, and I think there's so much value, and it's so important to talk and protect the working class, especially right now. But I did have bigger aspirations. I always knew I wanted to write. I always knew I wanted to travel. I had this sort of much bigger expectation for myself than anyone ever even put upon me. I just sort of came equipped with it. And so I was always sort of trying to struggle with stay close, be here, live nearby, have all the babies. There were little things like hanging baby clothes in my closet the second I was of age. That kind of thing. Like, she was ready for grandbabies and I was 16 years old and there were already grandbaby clothes being hung up in my closet, as if that were some sort of like message to me. And it was probably a very indirect sort of thing for her. And that was the way that she communicated support to me, you know, which was like, I'm here, we're going to do this. And I wanted something very different. And I did have the kids, but I travel with them and I move around. And it's really important to me to not just sort of live next door to her and have it be enough to live in a one little small town and raise a bunch of kids. It just was never my dream. And that is very much what she loves and who she is. And she was such a gracious and generous mother and very dedicated to that work. So we had this great expanse between us where she couldn't quite figure out why I ever wanted to work so hard on something that wasn't what she did. And I think also too, and this isn't just specifically about my mom, you know, I speak to a lot of my friends who are my age, who have mothers, my mother's age and a little older, just about this sort of strange idea that somehow we're doing our work to spite them or to be as different or get as far away from them as we can to foster some sort of expanse, some sort of division. And that's also something I really wanted to address in this book, which was none of my life was at my mother. I think women of that generation really think you're doing things at them to disown sort of their methodology of living as women. And maybe when you're in your 20s, that's a little true. But as you get older, you realize how much of your life you want to tether to those women. And that's what part of this book is also about.
So you were a very young mother. And in what way did becoming a young mother shape your journey?
I think entirely it shaped my journey. I mean, that's not the whole answer, but that's the real meat of the answer. It informed every decision I ever made. Obviously, when you become a mother, your entire purpose gets sort of inverted on you. And I only had a very small window of time where I could indulge in my own wants and needs. And so I think that created kind of a lifelong commitment to always making sure that I was really being effective with my work, with my time. I was very efficient. Not wasting time was a very big, like, vein running through my body. Like, I have literally 6 hours to make sure that I'm contributing to the work I care about. also in real literal ways and also in very bigger picture ways of making sure I had sort of a long road vision of my goals and also a daily sort of idea of how to accomplish this bigger picture. I'm very big picture driven. And so I think that that kind of creates, you know, not a lot of time for social interaction, not a lot of time for doing some of the things that other people do. My hustle kind of sometimes turned people off. It's easy for people to assign negative traits to that. And so you kind of just have to keep going and you have to just kind of ignore the people that assume the worst of you while you're trying to sort of get ahead, because you don't have the luxury. I'm not just trying to make money to feed a cat. Like, I legitimately have a life, like I have a life to support for not just me, but I help support these four lives with this one other human being who works just as hard as I do. And we're both so dedicated to our work as much as we're dedicated to our family. I mean, to simply answer your question, having kids has informed every decision, has been the path, and everything else has had to fall in line with how John and I have chosen to raise our kids, which is as two artists. I don't think either one of us walk around calling ourselves artists. I don't know why, but it makes us both uncomfortable. But that's the truth of it.
Well, you talk in the book about working at Margot's Cafe and how there was an expectation there that this was a family, and to show how committed you were to the place, there was an expectation to hang out and be together, and not being part of that family just didn't sit right with Margot herself, at least for a time, at least in the beginning, before she understood how committed you were. And as we know, there aren't a lot of moms in restaurants. How hard was that for you emotionally to like separate the two families, or to know that you weren't meeting the expectation of this woman you so greatly admired?
It was hard, but also it was something I was very used to. I don't like the fact that I'm always sort of an outlier, but that just seems to be the nature of the path I'm on. I've been an army brat my whole life. And then when I finally did settle into Nashville, I realized very quickly I would make all of these dynamic friends who were my age, but they were 27. They were wanting to go out and have themed 80s prom birthdays. And I literally never could show up, and it felt like a snub to them. And they are all becoming mothers now. So I'm sure that they're connecting the dots, that it wasn't because I didn't like them. I just couldn't afford to spend the time to create these social infrastructures. And it was no different with my job. I realized very quickly that one of my biggest downfalls with the restaurant industry was always going to be that my work was very important to me, and I was going to give it my best and do my best while I was there, and then I was going to go home. And I didn't have the capacity to build that sort of social clout that people seem to really benefit from in the restaurant industry in particular. I think it's just hard for people to understand that perspective until they're in it. Being a parent is something I think people truly can't grasp the weight of until they are in it themselves. And so I think I will perpetually sort of, in that sense, I feel like my 20s and 30s I spent as an outlier of all of my experiences, because I simply did not know anyone else who was raising a family while dynamically trying to build and have a career.
How do you think we change that going forward? I mean, the restaurant industry is in a moment of crisis, and we're trying to change so many things to make it sustainable. And it seems that the idea that restaurant life and parenting is not compatible seems like something that we could tackle and change. Like, what visions do you have for that?
Well, I think we're kind of seeing a generation of chefs now. They're not young parents like I was, but they're still becoming parents. And I think they're informing a conversation. I mean, like, look, Dave Chang and Chris Ying have a whole dad podcast now. And it's like really great to sort of hear. But also I do kind of, I'm like, all right, guys, I'm glad that it's sanctioned now. And those are two buddies of mine, right? Like, I'm like, okay, I kind of have a little bit of an eye roll, because fuck, I just spent 20 years in an industry kind of hiding the fact wish that I had this whole other life because it just never fit. And it's so hard to talk on like what the restaurant industry should be doing right now because God bless them. I mean, they're having the shit kicked out of them left and right. And it's so hard to sort of sit here and pontificate as a non-restaurant owner in this moment how they can do better. But I think this can be an opportunity if we can just get through this and buy some time. God, if our government could just give them some time, then I think we have the real potential to come out of this moment with real clear eyes about what the value is in our industry. It's each other. It's protecting and preserving our lives and what our lives are worth on a day to day. And I think for so long that was a forsaken idea. So, you know, if we get out of this, we absolutely have to talk about sustainable wages and health insurance and how to work in this really messed up capitalistic system we have to promote and provide sustainable lives for the people that work with us. And that's going to create professional servers, professional cooks, professional dishwashers, people that aren't just transient workers like the restaurant industry is typically so fraught with, you know. And I really believed and I worked really hard to try to open this bakery in Nashville for years. And how women get funded in this country, especially for restaurants and small businesses, is a total joke. But having, you know, those conversations with investors about why I wanted to pay my head baker a certain amount of money and also bottom line my health benefits and make those a priority, how those conversations were met with borderline disdain and disgust. I mean, these people are millionaires, you know, these people own freaking Hardee's. And after telling me that a head baker isn't worth $65,000 a year, which is barely middle class in this country, you know, they would turn on their heel and present to me an opening budget to that would afford them money to buy their handmade linen napkins from somebody that they know. And I'm like, you're not even thinking about what this means. You're not even thinking about labor costs to wash these things, wear and tear. And plus they cost more in one quarter than paying my head baker $65,000 a year. So we're done here. And so I think getting those people squarely out of the restaurant industry business is a very important priority.
Interesting. Well, I mean, you've had so many experiences. I was astonished to read that when you were at Husk, you were being paid hourly and at $15 an hour. Like that, along with a few other stories, that just stopped me in my tracks because you were such an important part of the story of that place and the success of that place. I don't want to lose the trail of motherhood for the moment, though. So you are the mother to a daughter, and you have, as you've described, sort of a chasm between you and your mother that also has a bridge. I mean, there's both. But in what way are you able to shape or reshape your relationship from the past with a new opportunity with your daughter?
I think in some ways my mom is the bridge for that question. And I think that's why I wanted to take so much time to sort of understand some of the pain and frustrations I think she has felt as a woman in this world. Because regardless of how I bully them out of me every day, they still are there. They still exist in very many ways of this like incredibly crushing self-doubt. And I know it's a common thing for everybody. No one wants to walk around and talk about like how little they value themselves in any given scenario. But I had to sort of face that for myself, even though I work really hard every day to not succumb to it. In some cases, I did succumb to it. The $15 an hour pay disparity thing with Sean, doing it a favor, giving him all of my intellectual property to a company that neither one of us are even a part of anymore, you know, that's devaluing yourself. And so I really, really wanted to figure out why I could do that. And that's not to say it's my mother's fault. I got real, almost physically kind of tired of having the conversation with myself of how I could keep accommodating basically other people's shit behavior. I thought, you know, this is really time for me to unpack it. I had no idea that when I wrote this book, it would go back to my grandfather, whom, again, I carry a deep sense of love and care for, but also can admit there's some contributing factors to his very distinct and very identifiable Southern Mississippi early 20th century. You can romanticize it by calling it grit and tenacity, but there's also this, there's this side that's a very painful side. And I talk about these things in the book, and I didn't really know I was going to go there. And it was hard for me to go there. And I knew it was going to be hard on my mom to go there as well. It's harder than I thought it was going to be to have this conversation with my mom, because she's done a lot of work to, I think, protect herself from these conversations. Because in all fairness, that's what you have to do at some point. And I think a lot of women of that generation have protected themselves from things that all of us can see. And I think a lot of the daughters don't want to carry with them anymore, especially those of us who are raising young women.
So you and your mother hadn't necessarily talked through all of the things that you had learned when you were sort of going back through your family history and then realizing where the seeds of some of this self-doubt came from. Is that what you're saying?
You know, I thought we had. I honestly was making a lot of phone calls. I was including her sister, whom I'm very close to, my aunt, and I was including her brother, whom I'm a little estranged from because he's a little bit of a tricky character. But I called him, and I was really trying my best. Part of the problem in this side of my family is after my grandmother died, we were all so deeply mired in all of her. Like I want to bring up all these examples, but we all were of her.
What's one example that you could just mention?
For example, for me personally, this wasn't everyone else's example, but we shared a bed together most of my life. I always felt like she was there even when she wasn't. We would, you know, say our prayers at night together, and she was constantly making me little tokens to remember her by, these embroidered pillowcases. She would tether little things into the seams of my clothes. Just small day-to-day things and then larger things. She just felt like such a large presence and still does. And I think anyone that comes from any kind of Mexican traditional family will tell you it's a real looming presence of the matriarch. And she was definitely almost a saintly version of that. And I think in some strange sense, her identity in my family when she was gone really sort of became such a troubling thing for everyone to reconcile. I think part of the obstacle with writing about this part of my family was that after she died, stories just sort of devolved into everyone else's version of the experiences. And so I was telling my mom, you know, she's like, you got a couple of details wrong. And I said, well, what? And she was like, well, this and that. And they were small details. And I said, well, what I had to kind of do, Mom, was take all of these stories from three different people and basically do what religious scholars do, is like find an ex-gospel and try to like find the one potential, you know, nugget of actual truth, because it's both been sort of mystified and buried. I really wanted to maintain deep honesty and integrity while also trying to, you know, really care for the people I was writing about. And these are people, well, for the most part, not everybody in the book, but most of the people I write about, I love deeply. And so when you're living in the space of writing a memoir, that's all you're doing. It's all you're thinking about. And I can probably assign now to myself that I didn't manage expectations as well as I could have. And if you can hear this and not attribute like negative aspects to the word, I was so depleted. I just spent over 3 years working on this one thing. I think I was out of courage, even maybe. My well was empty. I had given this everything I had, and there was some satisfaction to that. You know, I think anybody that writes or makes will tell you it's a double-edged sort of understanding of the word depleted, where you're like, this feels good. I exhausted everything that I had. I know I gave it my all, but also I have no more to give. I can't make another fucking phone call right now and just say, like, are we good? Everyone understand? And so I gave myself permission to sit with just the fact that it was done for a while. And so I think that was probably, looking back, the time I should have mustered some more and realized I wasn't actually done. But what can you do? Hindsight 2020.
Well, it took a ton of courage to write that book. I congratulate you on that. With that, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back. Mm-hmm.
I'm Lisa Held, a food journalist and podcast host, presenting Behind the Label with American Humane. Produced by Heritage Radio Network for Springer Mountain Farms, this podcast series dives into what the American Humane Certified label really means. We're looking inside the farm certification process, beginning with the moment a farmer expresses interest in becoming American Humane Certified, all the way to a consumer seeing the seal on store shelves.
And American Humane is our country's first national humane organization, founded way back in 1877. Now we certify nearly 1 billion farm animals each and every year. Despite that growth, roughly 90% of U.S. farm animals are still raised without the benefit of independently verified science-based standards.
Subscribe to Behind the Label with American Humane wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back. This is Dana Cowan, and you're listening to Speaking Broadly with guest Lisa Donovan. I loved the story of getting MFK Fisher's book and what a moment that was for you. Can you just talk about what reading has meant and how reading unleashed the writing or helped propel it forward?
Reading, I think, is such the seed for everything for me in so many ways. It's been my gateway to baking. It's been my gateway to travel. It's been my gateway now to learning about a bunch of things I didn't know about as a white woman in this world. And so that's always been sort of how I have educated myself. And even though I did go to college, I went to college with a kid on my hip. And so I have always had a stack of books somewhere near me. And finding that MFK Fisher book was very similar to me finding all of those early books 5 or 6, 7 years earlier about artisan baking, where I knew something was festering or germinating or evolving. And I was like, there's something here. And I know I'm ready for, there have been a couple of moments like that in my life where I can identify that I'm about to have like this phase 7 of evolution, you know, like, okay, this is your chance. Take this seriously, move up, push yourself a little farther. You're tired, but you can keep moving. And this is how, because it was also the time when I was like, why am I doing all this baking? I know it's making us a little bit of extra money every month, but I'm tired. And then you find these reasons, and these reasons present themselves to you. And all of a sudden, I had a larger understanding of community and food and that conversation of making something beautiful from not having, not even from nothing, but from not having, from really, really understanding and sitting with that feeling of lack and creating something, not even for yourself, but for other people, and understanding that the trick isn't making more for you, but getting something from making more for other people. And there was a real opportunity there because, you know, I was inching towards 30. I think I was 26 maybe. And we were struggling. We had this new baby. We had a 5-year-old. We had too many animals in our house. And like, we couldn't even afford to feed our dog. You know, we like literally got to the point where it was cheaper to buy a big, cheap bag of rice, steam him rice every day, put some nutritional yeast powder and a raw egg, because a friend of ours would always bring us eggs. She had chickens and would bring us free eggs every week. And he got the bulk of them. And the kids got the bulk of them. And he would have this awesome feast. He was this very old dog that thankfully didn't need to eat much anyway. And so we would make him this like ridiculously luxurious, but totally cheap, cheaper than dog food feast. And so we were just finding all of these ways to sustain and to keep everything from just falling completely off the cliff. And that book came in that moment when I was like, I don't have any more tricks. I got no more tricks. And then all of a sudden it opened up some crazy part of my soul, my inside, my heart, my capabilities, something opened. And I got just a little bit evolution phase 7 or whatever it was happened. So
I was interested throughout the book. You're just filled with these feelings that seem deep and old and always there, but you come across them at different times and they shape you in different ways. And I was wondering, do you feel that that's unique? And if it's not unique, then how do other people recognize those moments, because I feel like as we go through our lives, we're always looking for that sign, and sometimes we feel like we totally miss them. You, on the other hand, I feel like you're so attuned and you're so thoughtful that you can see these or feel these reverberations, and then they change your life. So how do you find them and how do you recognize them?
It sounds like I'm bragging now that you put it that way, but I don't mean to. I wish that I could stop paying attention to them sometimes. It took me 42 years to be able to say to myself, you're a deeply sensitive person, and that's okay. I think for so long that had some kind of negative connotation in my space and my world, like being sensitive meant you were touchy or whatever. But not even with myself, and this is going to probably sound ridiculous and very hooey, but like I have to make a very distinct effort when I walk into a room to manage and mitigate the vibrations in a room. And I'm hesitant to talk about things in a way that might sound like a fucking hippie, but like really, I wish that I could not feel things so deeply all of the time. That is just now starting to feel like a superpower instead of a weakness, like a deficit in my life. Because for so long, it just was like, I wish I could just stop listening and feeling this expectation. Like I'm constantly holding myself accountable to those feelings. And it's taken me a long time to not hold other people accountable to those feelings, if I'm being real. Like I am very private about it, you know, but I also can see very clearly sometimes other people's motivations in a way that makes me not want to look that way. I wish I could just be like, I'll take that at face value. No big deal. I'll be over here. But I think about it and I brew on it and then I write about it. And I've got so many piles of things about just someone's decision publicly to do this thing that I'll never publish. It was just my really raw take on it. And I mean, I often wonder like, God, am I just like the most exhausting person to be around? I don't know how to small talk. I don't know how to like just do anything casually. Everything's got to be some like big feeling. So I don't know if it's always good.
I wonder whether like that character trait of like wanting to go deeper and wanting to have the conversations and having these sensitivities is part of what helped you form these transformative relationships with extraordinary women, maybe not as soon as you would have liked, but eventually that has sort of shaped a part of your life.
I started to get really worried that it wasn't ever going to happen for me because of just, you know, the busyness of my life and the busyness of work and the busyness of child rearing and being a wife and wanting to be dedicated to all of those things, you know, with equity, it doesn't leave a whole lot of time to sort of have strong relationships with other women. And so, you know, I started to wonder in my 30s, like, when do I get to have my women? Where are my women? And all of a sudden, as soon as I was hungry for it and wanting for it, it just started to slowly build itself. And I started meeting the Angie Mosiers and the Ann Marshalls and the Chidi Kumars and the Rebecca Wilcombs. You know, I started meeting these women who have similar qualities. Whenever we're all on a Zoom call, my husband, he is always just like, I have no idea how you guys found each other, but Jesus fucking Christ. He's like, it's like a supernova. He's like, it is the craziest collection of women. It is truly, truly, absolutely, I think one of, I'm tearing up a little bit. Like it's one of the biggest rewards of my life.
How did you find them? And how do you nurture those relationships?
We nurture each other. There's just such an understanding. We found each other just bouncing around this industry in all various ways. And when we met each other, I think we instantly all just knew. We all met at different times. And then somehow this little union of four or five or six of us kind of got formed. And we have such grace with each other and such patience and kindness and understanding, and also this real important, like no bullshit, like there's no way that any of us are going to let the other get away with any kind of bullshit or go too hard on ourselves either. I think we all are harder on ourselves than we are anybody. And so from that place, we take such good care of each other. That's something that's very sort of like organically that has happened. You know, like my book release was on Tuesday of this past week. And one of my dearest friends, Angie Mosier, I didn't hear from her all day. And she texted me late at night. She's a photographer. And she's like, I have been doing this job all day. And she wrote this long text just full of apologies. And it was also like, none of that mattered. The tardiness of her text. And that was one of the most important notes I got all day, because everything she said after the real apology that she didn't need was the meat of like her saying to me, like, I'm so glad the rest of the world gets to finally see you the way I see you and hear you the way I hear you. And just saying all of the things that she knows. And it would be the same other way around. And that's such a beautiful, beautiful thing, because not all people are like that. I've had lots of friends where if I didn't go to their party, that was it. We weren't friends anymore. So the grace and the real importance of our relationships is just simply how clearly we see each other and how much we care for each other, like in a tender, tender way.
There have been some extraordinary women guides for you. And I'm thinking now of Alice Randall. I'd love for you to just talk about that notion of how meeting a singular person can open up a whole world to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, Alice Randall, I think, will forever be just someone I look at and hope I can build the kind of valuable work. She has actually a book coming out, too. And she just is full of that constant drive, and she's always thinking, and she's always challenging, and she's always ready to go deep. There's no small talk with Alice. There's no little conversations. And I can remember I drove her home after we all had a dinner last summer, I think it was. This year feels like a decade. And we sat in my car as we sat outside of her apartment downtown, and she talked to me about writing for an hour in my car. About publishing in particular, and about copy editing. We were just having a conversation as two writers, which was really exciting for me because I'd never gotten to be in that seat with her. I'd been a budding writer, as someone who was trying to sort of build the kind of experiences that would allow me to have the right to have a career like hers. And she was always there to give me advice. And I'll never consider her a peer. Let's say that first. I consider her a deity. So, but I sat there with her feeling, with her being generous and treating me as a peer, treating me as a writer, saying very honest things, being really frank, being really caustic, and just being funny and trying to just tell me her experiences. And I hold that experience as one of the most valuable experiences of my writing career.
Did she tell you anything that you're like, I will never forget that one thing? And if I'm ever lucky enough to be in this position where I'm sitting in a car with someone who is just coming up, I want to remember to tell them this thing that I was told tonight.
I mean, the funniest thing that she told me was, super proud of you for getting this first book deal. Your second book deal is probably going to come. Did you get a 2-book deal? And I was like, someone had advised me against it. I 1-book deal, and I'll try to get a 2nd book deal. She's like, you'll get a 2nd book deal, but let me tell you about the 3rd book deal. She's like, that 3rd book deal is the one that'll kill you. It was like she managing my expectations and like just talking about the cycles of publishing, and she'd seen it all. And the other thing that I really took to heart was her saying, even if you find yourself in a publishing house that you love and with editors that you love, which are all of the above true for me, I mean, super, super shout out to Penguin Press, because I tell you what, man, they have been soldiers for me and my vision with this book. But she sat there with me and said, just make sure, Lisa, that you set your intentions and you are the only one that gets to mitigate or change those expectations of this book. So that was hugely important to hear, even though I have felt so fortunate in my relationship with my publisher.
That sounds like an extraordinary spell of time. It brings to mind the Diana Kennedy story, where Diana Kennedy also seems to have had a sort of a pivotal conversation with you. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Oh, sure. That dinner was epic. I mean, that was my first time to San Francisco. That was like, I think it was the second or third time Kelly Fields and I had partnered on a dinner together. And it was for La Cocina, which is a very important organization in San Francisco. And it was a benefit for their 10th anniversary, I think. And it was to honor Diana Kennedy's work as well. So she was the guest of honor. They had a bunch of podcast recordings. She was floating around for 2 days. We all got to move around in a little posse together, which was like, what? Oh my God. You know, we walked into a couple of kitchens to tour so that they could meet Miss Kennedy. And I literally would walk into each room and just find a wall and press my back up against it because I was like, what the fuck is this? What am I doing right now? I'm in that, like, I'm literally Diana Kennedy's entourage right now. She's just swishing around in her leather pants and her turquoise jewels and just being, God, this incredible. She's not even, I know she's a human being, but God, she's just so otherworldly and remarkable. And I adore every way she comes at this world. And, you know, we served the dinner. Kelly and I had been planning this menu for, you know, months. And, we did this beautiful, it was a cornmeal tres leches cake, but we used, like, I brought buttermilk from Tennessee, and that's how I make my tres leches cake. And Kelly brought the cake because she makes this really beautiful, dense cornmeal cake that was perfect for, like, absorbing all of this liquid. And then I made a cayeta ice cream. And then when we got there, I found these beautiful apricots, which I write about in the book, to put on top. I mean, it was just a simple, it was very much like Kelly and Lisa style, and it was very Southern pastry chef style. We're a good team for a lot of reasons, and we pulled off this dinner, and at the end of the night, a couple of people run in and call us out of the kitchen, and she pulls us out of the kitchen to tell us that that was the best dessert she ever had, which, okay, it was like the capstone, was just like the end. Oh, I couldn't even, my knees were just weak all weekend anyway, and now I was like, this is the part where I just fall straight down. And of course, like, Kelly's just always so cool, and like, not in even an arrogant or shitty way, she just is cool and nothing phases her, and she's like, awesome. And I'm like, and so Kelly gets pulled away, and I have this really unreal, I'm pretty sure there was like a light behind her that made her look like a halo and everything. And I'm like looking at Diana Kennedy, and she is, you know, really blunt and really doesn't mince any words, and was basically like, which part did you make? And I was like, well, Kelly made the cake, and I just made all the things that, you know, soaked it and went on it and da da da. And she was like, oh, the flavor. Okay, the flavor. And like, well, then if you're this good, how come I don't know who you are? And I was like, well, and I started to say, well, the world doesn't really pay attention to the South yet and all these things. And, you know, who knows? Who knows why? But I didn't even have a chance to say that before she was like, I know why. And then proceeds to say the thing, which is, you know, sort of became this other moment of like, evolution phase 12 was like, you know, maybe you should stop letting men tell your story. And that was basically like her turning on her heel to go see her audience. And I was like, well, shit, I must have been wearing that all over me, because it was also during that time of like, every, you know, male chef I ever worked for just was building themselves houses and more restaurants and getting national notoriety. And male pastry chefs were in the news all of the time. Even ones that I admired and loved and respected would just get all of this airtime talking about how they do what they do because of their mamas, because of their mothers and their aunts and their grandmamas. And look at how I'm building my career on this sort of humble beginnings of just loving my mama, you know? And it's like, fuck off, I'm a mother. I can't make a living and I can cook as good as you. And so, like, I must have been wearing it. I must have been whatever. I don't know why she knew that's what I needed to hear. I don't know. But it was right in the height of that moment of realization that I was in an industry that would always create a space to revere women. But also then, I think I even write, like, we revere women straight into abjection, you know, in our culture where, yeah, it's great. But what kind of lives do we get to sort of create for ourselves that aren't just as idols or support staff for men? So that was a real, like, something definitely got flipped in my head then, where I was like, God damn, she's right. And if I don't start trying to tell my story about my food, my son will have to do it one day.
I have touched a couple of times on money. It was a driver of so much of your early years and just scraping by. I love how you really got to be an expert at taking care of like the finances, but in the scrappiest kind of a way. How do you think about the role of money in becoming who you are and finding your voice? Like, what holds you back and what could be possibly enabling?
Well, I think it's a good time to say that when people are barely living above the poverty level, which a lot of people in our country are, it's increasingly difficult to be a positive, like, contributing member of society, you know? And I think that as a country, we really lose sight of how hard it is for families to support themselves and also really strive for better education, strive for better opportunities for themselves and their kids. And so I think having the conversation about money for me is much bigger picture than how it maybe affected me and how I see it constantly affecting just the working class. And I think there's a real misunderstanding. A big frustration of mine and John's has constantly been the seeming lack of true understanding of what it means if, okay, you open a restaurant, you hire somebody, you're not really paying them much, but they know that they're willing to earn up and work hard. But then you as a restaurant decide that on your first year, and this is an experience that I actually had, you know, the owner's salaried, the sous chef salaried, the GM salaried, but everybody else is day to day. And I think for people who have never actually been close to poverty or in poverty, don't understand what closing a restaurant for a week does to a family. They don't really have the capacity to understand that a Christmas vacation that a restaurant is going to take for 3 weeks is a moment of peril for a family because you're not getting paid and you need those hours and you need that work and you need consistency and you need your employer to care about those dark moments that they decide to take a holiday. One of the first restaurants I worked at, the first year had this crazy schedule where it, I think on paper, seemed like a good idea because I think in some ways the owners were trying to initiate the first sort of beta version of let's all have a sustainable schedule and would, you know, close a week for a Super Bowl. And it was like, that was when they would choose their holiday. And then they'd be closed a couple of weeks during the summer. And on paper, you can understand like, well, that's good for restaurants. They should take care of themselves and have time off. But the thing is, we don't live in a country that supports that. In France, they can be closed a month every year because their culture and government in some ways supports that lifestyle. We don't have that. And so I think people really have a real expansive misunderstanding between when families like mine at the time say, we're really dangerously close to not being able to survive here, what that actually means. We've literally cut trees down of public parks to put in our fireplace because we couldn't keep our heat on. Like, we're talking like Charles Dickens shit here, you know? Like, we definitely were working way too hard to not be able to survive. So, you know, that for me, like, paved my way, and I'm scrappy and I can make something out of nothing. I'll say yes to any work, basically. I mean, right now I'm saying yes to private chef jobs just because I don't want to ever lose the ability to have that work. And in a lot of ways, we don't necessarily need that right now. And I would love to just be full time trying to forge ahead as a writer, but I'll never not have that insecurity. I could have $50,000 in the bank, which has never happened yet. Yet. See how I say yet. But I will go to the grocery store and have deep anxiety about my card not working till the day I die. So in some ways, yeah, like, it's a little debilitating sometimes. But I think the reason I want to talk about money is because I want people who have never felt that financial insecurity, I think it's really important for you to understand how desperate it is.
At the end of each podcast, I ask my guests two questions. One, and this might be very, very hard for you, is to give a shout out broadly to a woman who you believe more people need to know about. I say hard because I just know there's more than 10 Mount Rushmores of amazing women that you'd probably want to give a shout out to. But who would you like to give a shout out to today?
I got asked the same question by Kat Kinsman, and my answer was Erica Council, and my answer is still Erica Council. And I think she's definitely gotten, you know, more attention and more notoriety. She's a baker in Atlanta, Georgia. And all the while that, like, me and Kelly Fields and Cheryl Day have been hustling the Southern baking conversation, she's been right alongside us. And she is, bar none, the best baker of us all. I shouldn't say that about Cheryl and Kelly. I just think that she is such a valuable player, such a strong baker with such an important history. And right now she's got, I think her website has historically always been Southern Soufflé, but she has just started this new pop-up called Bomb Biscuits. And it's both a pop-up and a delivery service around Atlanta. And it just looks like the finest thing you could ever experience. So,
of course, I immediately want to know, you know, is she selling nationally? Does she freeze them and ship them? Because I love a good biscuit. Yeah.
Well, this is my pitch to her publicly, that she absolutely should do that. And what I'm hoping, because I can't get them either. And so what I'm hoping is that the next evolution of this for her is like a frozen shipment that we can all experience. Because I tell you what, I mean, even if you just look at a picture of her biscuits, you're like, it's too much. It's too much. She's got this remarkably, like, incredible heritage of Black chefs in Georgia that everyone should explore. And I just think she's one of the finest people on the planet too. She's just such a good lady, and she's a mother, and she kind of suffers from that same, she doesn't suffer. I just think that culturally we all suffer as women, but she sort of suffers from that strange thing of people not knowing where to place her because, I don't know that she works in restaurants altogether that much, and she tries to balance her role as a mother and as a really important Southern baker. She makes that work for herself, which I think is, you know, it always takes a little bit more effort for the public to figure out where to put people who aren't always just restaurant chefs.
I'm delighted to learn about her, and I will dive into her history. That's fantastic. And the last question is there a product or an ingredient that you think is better than the hype, something that everyone should use that they don't?
You know what I've been really into over the pandemic is spices. And it started because I think I would just like inadvertently pick up spices on my travels, and that was easy. And then I wasn't traveling, and I use spices so regularly. And I'm also getting a little lazy, I think, like everyone else in my cooking. And so I'm having a little bit of a harder time like inspiring myself. But what has been inspiring to me are two spice companies. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to order that. And Burlap and Barrel is one of them. And they're based out of Brooklyn. And someone sent me a huge gift shipment of all of their things. And they have a lot of pre-mixed spices as well that you should totally check out. And then Diaspora Company is a really good one. And someone gifted me some of their pepper. Those are two companies I'm super pumped about. And they both are just fine products, like really good, really high quality. And I think everything's sustainable. I think the really beautiful thing about Diaspora Company is that is woman color, queer owned, like really incredible company. So I'm excited about spices right now because they make everything better.
Well, I just want to thank you so much, Lisa, for coming on to Speaking Broadly. I've loved talking to you, and I'm sure we have another lifetime of conversation to have, because your book is rich and deep and purposeful and beautiful, and everyone should go buy it. It must be an interesting time to publish a book in the middle of a pandemic, but lots of people are reading, so there's a great opportunity. I hope I send all you listeners out to buy the book, and I hope I see you either virtually or in person sometime soon. So thank you for joining me. Thank you, all you listeners, for joining us today. And we'll be back next week with another episode of Speaking Broadly. Thanks.
Thanks, Dana.
Speaking Broadly is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without the support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.